my jurisdiction doesn't include those. But for you, they are truths.
Yes.
The smile grew more rigid. They will fall away. Love, family. Without the support of money and power, even they will fall away. He rubbed a long, flat hand across his knee, as if polishing it. You have family?
Yep.
Children? A daughter and a grandchild on the way. Wife?
Passed 7 years ago. Cancer.
I am sorry. He looked at me with those dark eyes for a while longer and then unfastened his safety belt.
What about your family, Mr. Bidarte?
He sat there, looking through the windshield of my truck toward the entrance of the emergency room.
I have only her left.
Isaac Bloomfield met us at the double-swinging doors, past the mauve waiting room. I looked around for the other two medical musketeers, but evidently the doc had decided to give them the afternoon off. Isaac studied Tomas through his thick lens glasses.
She's right in here.
We followed as he made an immediate left and down the hall to room 22. Big Wanda was propped against a team of pillows and was reading from a Gideon Bible that she'd procured from the nightstand. She looked up, and her cheeks bunched back in a joyous smile when she saw her son.
Tomasito!
He hurried to the bed and embraced her, but then quickly stepped back and looked at us.
I would like a moment with her alone, please.
Sure. I escorted Bloomfield out the door into the hallway and past the unoccupied nurse's station where the wall clock ticked loudly and the coffee pot was always on. I snagged a styrofoam cup from the stack and poured myself one.
Doc?
No, thanks. He waited a moment and then added,
You look tired.
I brought my coffee over to the counter and rested my elbows on the plastic wood-grained surface. In answer to your observation, I'm operating on about 2.5 hours sleep. We both straightened as Tomas came through the doors.
I am ready to go.
That was quick. I gulped what passed for coffee at Durant Memorial and tossed the cup in the trash.
All right.
I will be taking my mother with me.
I glanced at Isaac, who spoke in a conciliatory tone.
I'm afraid you'll have to allow for the 24 hours that's customary with cases of concussion, even mild concussion.
Bidarte folded his arms, and I listened to the leather of his jacket crinkle like the skin on a snake.
All right, if it's really necessary.
He turned to me.
But I will need the vehicle she was driving.
We all listened to the clock above the nurse's station as it ticked. Or at least I did.
That might prove to be difficult, too.
I'd explained that the car had been impounded and that it would take longer to get it. Tomas supervised the loading of the groceries while George sat in the truck. The job, obviously, beneath him. I promised Bidarte that I'd check on the station wagon while they ran some errands in Gillette, told him that I would leave word with Ruby as to how he should proceed, and gave him one of my cards. He'd left without saying goodbye. I drove over to Ray's Sinclair, which had been Ray's Shell, Ray's Texaco, and Ray's Red Crown before that. It was an old-style two-bay filling station, the office with a wall of glass block on the side. The bathroom key was attached to an exhaust manifold, and as far as I knew, no one had ever bought one of the withering candy bars from the glass case upon which the cash register sat. No one came to Ray's for the ambience. They came for Fred Ray, automobile mechanic extraordinaire. I walked through the office, and underneath the shark-like looks of a familiar 69 Mustang GT convertible that was on a lift in one of the bays. Ray was loosening the drain plug on the oil pan of the 428 Super Cobra jet engine. I reached up and placed a hand on one of the original bias ply tires.
So you're the one that keeps this thing in shape for Barbara Thomas, huh?
The mechanic smiled at me through the grease smudged on his chin and upper lip.
Do you believe this thing has only 17,000 miles on it?
He rolled over an oil-catching container and unscrewed the plug the rest of the way, catching it in his well-trained hand, before the golden liquid could carry it into the barrel. He brought his fingers up, catching a little of the viscosity and rubbing it between his fingers.
She lets that nephew of hers drive it with her in the passenger seat, about 100 miles a year, and then sends it in here to get the oil changed and to keep it serviced. Hell, the biggest problem is keeping the battery charged.
Why doesn't she just give it to Mike?
Ray laughed. She's afraid he's going to hurt himself in it. Can you believe that? I mean, he's what, 50 years old?
He shook his head and placed the drain plug on the top of the barrel.
She thinks he's 17.
He glanced up at the mammoth engine in the small car.
Hell, maybe he would kill himself driving it. I know I would.
He wiped his hands on a red cotton rag.
You looking for the demolition derby?
Yep.
Next stall over.
I nodded and walked through the doorway into the chaos of the garage, pieces of Plymouth Satellite scattered everywhere.
Boy, howdy.
Sizer Vittoria's head appeared with an inside door panel in his hands.
There is nothing in this car except car.
I nodded and walked over to where the back seat sat with some cardboard boxes and squatted down.
Where's Vic?
Under here.
Her voice echoed off the concrete floor, and she rolled a creeper from underneath the Plymouth with a trouble light in her hand and a black grease smudge on her nose, looking completely at ease.
I want that Mustang.
I bet you do. Everybody in the county wants that Mustang. I studied her. She had a rag tied around her head in the front, like Rosie the Riveter, and she was wearing a pair of coveralls she must have borrowed from Ray. She looked hot, as she always did.
You're enjoying this, right?
Among my Uncle Alphonse's numerous nefarious enterprises, he had a chop shop on Christian Street where I used to do lube jobs.
I bet you did.
She smiled and disappeared under the car again.
I was very good at it.
I bet you were.
I caught the Basco's eyes as he stood with his fists on his hips.
Anything at all?
He sighed.
Nothing.
I nodded and fingered the flap on the largest cardboard box beside me.
Well, we need to put it all back together as fast as we can, since I promised Tomas that we'd let him drive it back to East Spring later this afternoon.
Vic's head reappeared like a snapping turtle.
You're kidding.
Nope.
I flipped the flap open and looked inside.
I'm sure we can get Ray to help us put it back together.
Reaching into the box, I moved some of the newspaper that surrounded a metal housing.
What's this?
Sizer Vittoria peered over the top of the station wagon.
That's that differential yoke I was talking about, the one we found in the spare tire well. I didn't look at it closely, but it's huge and weighs a ton. So I don't think it goes on the Plymouth.
With both hands, I ripped the cardboard and looked at the massive piece, then turned it over. From this angle, it looked like nothing that could possibly go on any automobile, but especially this one. Vic rolled the rest of the way out from under the Plymouth.
What is that thing, anyway?
I looked more closely at the piece of industrial equipment. This is a polycrystalline, diamond-hued tricone drilling bit. Chapter 10. Before Howard Robard Hughes, Jr. became a business magnate, engineer, aviator, film producer, philanthropist, Jane Russell's bra inventor, and all-around loony, he was the 19-year-old inheritor of 75% of Howard Robard Hughes, Sr.'s empire. Like most billionaires, Howard Hughes was not a self-made man. The backbone of his fortune was built upon the development of the modern oil drilling bit already patented by the family company Hughes Tool in 1909. Being a pretty shrewd Texas oil man, H.H. Sr. had made the lucrative decision to lease the bits rather than sell them after he commercialized them. I'm not sure if Jr. ever came to Wyoming, even though Paramount offered to sell him Shane, the film they'd made in Jackson Hole, because it was so far over budget. Hughes turned down the opportunity, even though he hadn't seen it. Rumor had it that Paramount had settled on the loss and was going to turn the movie out to pasture as just another odor when Howard finally viewed the rough cut of the film. He offered to buy it outright, Paramount reconsidered, and the rest, as they say, is cinematic history. If Hughes never made it to Wyoming, however, his daddy's invention did. I'd seen it the summer I spent roughnecking after my senior year in high school, which was another part of my father's campaign to teach me the value of higher education. All the lessons had taken, and I'd spent the next 4 years as an English major at the University of Southern California in an attempt to never return to the oil fields.
So far it had worked. The two-cone roller bit, and more important, its descendant, the three-cone roller bit, looked like the mouth of one of Frank Herbert's giant sandworms in Dune, and with the addition of diamonds, it appeared to have gone gangsta. Double Tough spelled it out for Vic and me, his Appalachian drawl fitting the description. $170,000 if it's a penny. I studied the toothy-looking piece of heavy equipment that had taken two of us to lift onto the desk of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Office substation in Powder Junction, our version of the French Foreign Legion and possibly the most depressing place in the world. I glanced up at a massive, yellowed map of the area, so old that the interstate highway didn't even appear on it. I noticed a cot in the back room through the open door and assumed this was where Double Tough was sleeping while Freimeyer had his fiancée in town. "Do you guys ever think about fixing this place up a little?" He ignored me, rolled one of the teeth in the device, and picked a thick fingernail at one of the diamonds. "Polycrystalline, but they're diamonds nonetheless. Hell, I only seen one of these one other time, and that was down in Bolivia." I sipped coffee from the cracked hole-in-the-wall bar mug. "I'll kick in some county money if you want to get a rug or something." Vic's voice rose behind me. "Look who's talking about home decor." Double Tough's shoulder muscles rolled as he took the device and turned it over, looking at the manufacture marks from under the bill of his ball cap. "Use Christensen. That's the real deal. The Cadillac of drill bits?" He glanced up at Vic, standing by the desk. "More like a damn Lamborghini." She smiled. "Did you know they made tractors before they made cars?" "No shit." His eyes shone as he visually caressed the bit. "The Chinese are making a bunch of cheap stuff, but that right there is the real deal." He whistled through his teeth. "Directional drilling and anti-whirl technology. That old boy will go just about anywhere you want to point it." I set the mug on the corner of his desk. "Water?" His eyes came up. "Yeah. But it'd be like plowing your field with that Lambo," he smiled. "The car, not the tractor." He studied the shaft of the beast. "It's got a lease mark here. I've still got some connections in the biz, and I can give him a call to try and find out who it was leased to." "Why not call Hughes Christensen?" He shrugged. "Well, I don't want to get anybody in trouble." I glanced up at Vic, standing by the desk with her arms folded, as she reached over, picked up the receiver, and handed it to him. "Fuck it, get him in trouble." The ex-roughneck shrugged and began dialing. I walked over to the window in the door and looked through the sun-faded, peeling decal of our star past the weather-beaten station wagon at the playground across the street. We hadn't planned to be looking out the window at a public school from every office we had, but that's how it had panned out. Vic joined me at the door as Double Tough spoke on the phone. "Why would they have something like this, and why would it be hidden the way it was?" "I don't know." She paused to pick up the box that the bit had been in, partially crushed and filled with Mexican newspapers. The side read, "Mission Tortilla Rounds, Restaurant Style, Irving, Texas." "Do you think they had it and forgot about it?" Tapping the lid of the box with a forefinger, I laughed. "If you had a $170,000 piece of equipment..." She finished the statement for me as she looked at the vehicle belonging to the Apostolic Church of the Lamb of God. "In the spare tire well of that piece of shit Brady Bunch station wagon, no. I wouldn't forget about it. I'm betting that's why they are more interested in the car than in Big Wanda." She pulled one of the wadded newspapers from the box and stretched it flat. "Ciudad Juarez. They've got a sale on tire tread sandals." She glanced around, and when it became apparent that I wasn't paying any attention to her, she nudged me with an elbow. "Hey." "Yep." "Thanks for not sending me down here. I think I might have slit my wrists." I looked through the dirt on the window and realized the majority was on the inside. "I liked it when Lucian sent me down here, but you're welcome." "What are you thinking about?" "I'm wondering how the Apostolic Church of the Lamb of God is all of a sudden paying off hundreds of thousands of back taxes up and down the Great Plains." I let out a long, slow exhale. "Something is going on with these people."
"You think?"
I did think, and turned, and looked at Double Tough as he hung up the phone. They're going to call me back, and I have to admit that it was fun telling them this had to do with a criminal investigation, and they better do it pronto.
I nodded. They say they're drilling a new water well over at East Spring Ranch. Is there any reason why they would use a bit like this for that kind of application?
He considered.
Well, it's a rock bit. I guess if you are bound and determined to drill a water well in one spot, you might use it if you ran into a lot of rock.
Like down here in the southern part of the county,
I guess.
I studied him. You don't sound convinced.
I'm not. Why not just move the well?
Anyway, he gestured toward the Diamond Jim Brady of Bits, it'd be overkill to use a piece of equipment like this.
So what would you use it for?
I told you, oil, gas, something worth big money. I thought back to the detailed description I'd given him at the beginning of the conversation.
Could you drill oil or gas with the kind of rig I described seeing down at East Spring? The one on the back of the Peterbilt?
Not here, no way. He shook his head, and I watched as his mind sank into the ground, plummeting through the strata he knew so well.
It's all tapped out, at least the stuff that's easy to get to. You'd have to drill almost 12,000 feet before you got to the Niobrara Shale, Shannon and Sussex Formation above that. You're talking about a 10,000-foot vertical well with possibly a 5,000-foot lateral section and setting up the equipment to sell the oil. You're looking at a good $10 million just to get started.
He sat on the corner of the desk and placed a hand lovingly on the bit.
Do your friends over in East Spring Ranch have that kind of money?
I don't think so.
Anyway, they'd have to permit that kind of activity through the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, especially if they were God-fearing and law-abiding.
Well, the jury is still out on at least one of those. Vic joined us in staring at the pit.
What would you do with the oil?
Doubletough laughed.
Tanker trucks, sir. Better yet, the pipeline.
Have you seen any activity like that down here?
No, but I haven't been looking.
But you say there isn't enough oil to bother with.
He shook his head. Not on an industrial scale. I glanced back out the window. A familiar pickup filled to the gills with men had pulled in behind the station wagon. Right now, I have to go return some rightful belongings. I started toward the door, but watched as he rolled the bit over on the table with a loud thunk.
That include this?
Not unless they ask for it. The phone rang, and he reached for the receiver.
What are you going to do?
Vic tossed the box to the floor and followed as I turned the knob and pushed open the door.
Go fishing.
Roy Lanier was seated on his throne atop the Super Duty and was holding a somber sort of court.
Hello, Sheriff.
Mr. Lanier. He leaned forward and I watched as Lockhart, the guy with the crew cut, got out of the driver's side and stood by the door. Another man stood at the front corner of the bed and looked at Vic and me. It was only after a moment that I noticed the swollen eye and recognized him as the guy I'd punched in South Dakota.
My driver is Mr. Tom Lockhart, and I believe you're acquainted with Mr. Earl Gloss.
I studied him for a moment and then looked back at the driver, the grip of a semi-automatic just visible under a navy windbreaker. I returned my eyes to Lanier. I was hoping to see Mr. Bedard. I was hoping he was doing better. The big man glanced back at Gloss, who immediately started for the station wagon.
I think he's thrown himself into his work at the ranch. Some men respond that way.
He tried to keep my attention, but I watched as the man with the swollen face walked to the back of the car and tried the rear door, which was locked. I thought about tossing the keys to Vic, but she'd stepped to my left to keep an eye on Lockhart. I started toward the station wagon and watched as Gloss's eyes widened and he glanced at his boss, then to me again, before reaching toward the small of his back.
Just so you know, I won't have hands laid on me again.
I paid no attention and kept coming, watching out of the corner of my eye as Vic countered to face the other man.
Really?
I was putting my hand in my jacket pocket when Gloss slipped a late model, expensive-looking .45 from his waistband and pointed it toward me.
Don't come any closer.
I wasn't too concerned, seeing as how I could tell it wasn't cocked. Granted, any capable marksman could pull the hammer back if there was a round in the chamber, but I got the feeling from Gloss that he was not a member of that group, at least not with a uniformed armed officer bearing down on him. He raised the pistol a little higher, directing it toward my face.
I'm not telling you again.
Sometimes you can slap a sidearm out of a shooter's hand. It's a roll of the dice because sometimes you can't, and then they shoot you. But I was feeling full of piss and vinegar and took the chance. Gloss's pistol flew through the air and into the soft dirt on the far bank of the barrow ditch between the road and the school parking lot. Standing close to him, I dangled the keys between us and then bent over to unlock the tailgate of the old station wagon. Gloss glanced at his gun a good 20 feet away.
You had no right to do that.
I turned the key, the rear window whirring down with a herniated whine, and then lowered the door. Just for the record, I had every right. Just because you can carry a sidearm doesn't mean you can brandish and threaten a sworn officer. I tossed him the keys and then stepped back. He glanced at Lanier for a moment and then reached in, immediately opening the spare well where the drill bit had been. He pulled out of the station wagon and quickly shook his head.
Lose something?
I just don't like driving without a spare.
I addressed Lanier, coolly watching from the mountaintop of his mobile throne. It was easy to see who was the brains of the outfit.
Did you ever get your drill rig running?
His head canted to one side.
Unfortunately, we're still working on it.
I received a call from the county assessor's office about the logistics of your water well, and they wanted someone to run down with a GPS and get the exact location of the drill site. He didn't smile.
Is that so?
I went ahead and smiled. I'm friendly that way. I volunteered for the job.
I'm sure you did.
I gestured toward Vic, still facing the driver. We'll be there tomorrow, if you can make arrangements for someone to meet us at the gate around noon.
I'll see what I can do.
If not, I'll just run through it. Lanier nodded, and I got the feeling we'd made progress in clarifying our relationship. But our stare down was interrupted by Gloss, having moved from the station wagon and going for his pistol at the far side of the ditch.
I wouldn't do that if I were you.
He stopped at the sound of my voice.
That's my gun.
Yep, it is, and we have another law here in Wyoming concerning unauthorized firearms brought onto school property. It comes with a mandatory sentence, and that weapon now is most certainly on school property. He glanced at the autoloader, gleaming in the dirt like an unobtainable treasure.
Well, what am I supposed to do?
I guess decide if that pistol is worth 5 to 7 years in Rawlins. It's a nice enough town, but I'm not sure if the accommodations at the maximum security prison are all that great. Vic, still standing off the driver, volunteered in a loud voice,
fish sticks and tater tots on Fridays.
I think she even winked at Lockhart. Lanier's voice intoned from the truck.
Earl, I think it's time we were going.
Gloss circled around, careful to go to the front of the wagon in order to avoid me, then threw open the door of the Plymouth and climbed in.
I want my gun back.
Just as soon as I check the serial numbers and you show me a Wyoming or Texas permit for carrying it.
He slammed the door and probably would have headed out in a tire-squealing, fish-tailing, thunder-roding display if the tired satellite's ignition hadn't given out with a terminal and diminutive click. I glanced at Lanier.
You guys have any jumper cables?
Back in my office, Vic examined Gloss's Wilson Combat Supergrade Classic, jacking the slide mechanism over and over and spitting shiny 45 dum-dum rounds onto my desk with a determined ferocity. It would have hurt if he'd shot you, you know.
Right.
She held up one of the pursed open-tip rounds. These hurt worse than normal, you know that, right?
Right.
She was pissed, but she kept her voice low so that no one else in the outside office could hear her.
You're a moron. You know that too, right?
Right.
If that shitbird had shot you, then I would have had to shoot everybody, which doesn't really concern me, but after that I would have had to lift your 260-pound...
I'm down to 245.
She shot an index finger at me. Shut the fuck up.
Right.
Ass off the roadway and load you into your unit, drive at the speed of light in hopes that you would not leak all your precious bodily fluids out onto the floor mats and die. She leaned back in my guest chair, her eyes like twin black holes with surrounding solar flares
swallowing everything, and all I could think was how ferociously gorgeous she looked. Thoughts that, if were voiced, would most likely put my life in jeopardy again. I eased back in my chair. Can I talk now?
No, you cannot talk until you show some semblance of being able to behave like a rational, reasonable law enforcement professional.
I considered. I'm not going to be able to talk for the rest of my life.
No.
I glanced out my window and honestly reflected on my actions earlier. I'm sorry.
She yanked herself forward and hissed. Don't say that. Don't even say that, because all that's going to do is piss me off even more. And you want to know why? Because you don't mean it. You walk around with this 10-foot-tall and bulletproof attitude, which, I might add, you should have gotten over during that last little jaunt in the mountains.
That's how I lost the 15 pounds.
Shut the fuck up.
She was really angry now, and stood, still holding the confiscated 45.
There are a lot of people around here who kind of depend on you, you know.
She paced and then stopped, taking a deep breath and running her fingers through her hair.
A lot of people. And if you're not going to think of yourself, then maybe you should think about them.
She scratched the end of her nose with the barrel of the semi-auto. Being a fast learner, I said nothing. With very little warning, she tossed the Wilson onto my desk, where it struck my leather blotter with a resounding thud and slid toward me.
That is a $5,000 sidearm. What the hell is Farmer Green Jeans doing with a gun like that?
I raised my hand. She dismissed me with a flapping of her own.
Talk.
I don't know. She turned to look down at me.
You use your opportunity to talk for that?
I shrugged and studied her and gestured toward the pistol on my desk. At the risk of you loading the aforementioned weapon and shooting me, are you all right? She turned very slowly.
What is that supposed to mean?
I put my hand on the 45 and slid it out of her reach.
I just want to be clear about this.
She thumped a forefinger at her chest.
I'm dressing you down, and you're asking what's wrong with me?
You just seem a little on edge. She walked over and closed my office door the rest of the way, and then came back and sat in front of me on my desk, near me and the pistol.
Fuck you again. I am trying to have a serious conversation about your recent juvenile actions, and you're trying to use that hackneyed old chauvinistic tactic of blaming all this on my emotions?
I raised my hand again. She raised a tactical boot and planted it firmly between my legs, grabbed the front of my shirt, and pulled me in close, forcing me to grab the arms of my chair for balance.
I am in complete control of my emotions.
As they go, it was the Mount Vesuvius of kisses. Shocking, overpowering, molten, and leaving nothing but paralyzed ash in its wake. I thought for a moment I was going to suffocate when she released the fistful of my shirt like the ripcord on a parachute. Her face hovered there, and I continued to breathe her breath, feeling the warmth of it on my jaw and neck.
Any more questions about my emotions?
Nope. She pushed with the foot, and I felt my boot dislodge. It was only then that I realized that my chair was flipping backward. I scrambled to grab the edge of my desk, Vic, or anything, but she'd already stood and stepped away, and I crashed backward onto the carpet-covered, but still unforgiving, hardwood floor. I lay there, attempting to focus my eyes and get the air back in my lungs, as she walked over and stood above me, her hair framing her face like anything but a halo. The back of my head hurt, and I squeezed my eyelids together in an attempt to purge the ache that was starting at the back of my head. She leaned over at the waist to inspect me crawling from the wreckage, and whispered in a sultry voice,
I didn't call on you, teacher's pet.
Boy, howdy. Reaching a hand up, I was able to graze my fingers across her muscular calf as she turned and marched away. My eyes closed again for what I thought was only a moment, and when I opened them, she was gone, and a different head, panting with a different sort of breath and with a worried look on his long face, was hanging over me. Unsure, he slathered a lick on the side of my head with a tongue as wide as a paperback, correcting the belief that a good kiss made everything better. Well, almost everything. I reached up and grabbed his ruff and massaged his ear. How you doing, rascal? He wagged and disappeared as I noticed someone standing in my doorway.
Walt?
I tried my best to sound casual.
Yep. I heard a crash.
That would have been me. Ruby walked in, and I noticed she was wearing a pair of her sporty, reflective running shoes. Funny the things you noticed from this perspective.
What's up? Sizer Vittoria wants to talk to you, and Double Tough is on line one. Something about a leased piece of drilling equipment?
Could you hand me my phone and tell the Basco where I am?
Sure.
She rested the whole thing on my chest, picked up the receiver and handed it to me, a finger poised to punch the button.
Do you mind if I ask what you're doing?
Nope, I don't mind at all. We both waited. Finally, she pushed the button and then smeared a thumb over my lips.
You might want to get rid of the lipstick. It doesn't become you.
I watched as she stood and disappeared out my door. Do we have any aspirin? Readjusting the receiver in the crook of my neck, I thought about getting up, but I wasn't really that uncomfortable, so I just spoke.
What have you got for me, Tuff?
Hey, Chief. Hughes Christensen got back to me and let me tell you that's the fastest that's ever happened.
What do they say?
It's stolen.
Well, fancy that.
There was a rustling of paper as he read from his notes.
The original leasing was through Pemex, the Mexican government-owned petroleum company.
The big dog, huh?
Big to the tune of $415 billion in assets.
I whistled.
How did they even notice?